Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, the Senior Director of the JPC and your host. Before we go to today's guest, Professor Mark Meyerowitz, here is your JPC commercial. So people ask me why, after more than 2 years of webinars, I'm still doing the commercial. Thank you for asking, because it gives me two reasons to brag. First, about the JPC. And second, to say that every week we have some new people on the webinar, and I want them to know what they've signed up for, which is great. And you can always send your webinar invitation to your friends and grow the circle. The JPC was established in 1985 as a 501c3 organization, providing insights on domestic and foreign policy. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our Insight articles and our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. The Israel issue of In Focus Quarterly is up right now, and next month the summer issue will be out with a reassessment of America's international priorities. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. A reminder, you are muted. Please use the Q&A function, though, to send us questions as Professor Meyerowitz speaks. And now let me introduce him. Dr. Mark Meyerowitz is Professor of Humanities at the Maritime College of the State University of New York. He specializes in Turkish foreign policy, U.S.-Turkish and Turkish-Israeli relations, which perhaps will be a topic for another day. But he's also a professor of American history, foreign policy, and the Constitution. He has taught classes in the Supreme Court and the Constitution, perfect subject for today, American political parties and the presidency, the immigrant experience in America, American cultural history, in America in the 20th century, which we believe he is upgrading now to the 21st century. Mark holds a PhD in political science from Fordham University and a JD from Brooklyn Law School. He's written for us here at In Focus. In 2020, he provided a blueprint for American policy toward China following the onset of the COVID pandemic, including restructuring international organizations, building our alliances in the Pacific, and countering China's 5G efforts and its Belt and Road Initiative. Last year, he wrote on American political polarization. I strongly recommend that you go to the website and read Mark Meyerowitz on American political polarization. As you can see, he is a Renaissance man. So it's with great pleasure, Mark Meyerowitz, that I turn the floor over to you.
Thank you very much, Shoshana. And it's a tremendous privilege to work with you and do this webinar and to work with you on any project. And what an honor it has been to write for In Focus, to do these webinars. I can't tell you how meaningful it is. You gave me a very, very big topic today. I think it's called State of the World 2022. And I'm supposed to figure out in a couple of minutes how to work this through. But the focus that we're going to talk about today is really the international system and international institutions. How are they doing? How have they done, particularly in the context of the two big shocks that the system has experienced? First of all, the COVID-19 pandemic, which was a tremendous shock to the international system, and of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There are many ways to look at this, but I just thought I'd kind of delve into it, pick a few institutions and see what they're all about. And are they still viable? And we complain a great deal about these institutions and how useless they are. Is the question is, are they really useless? Do they have any efficacy? How have they functioned? Now, they're starting off with the United Nations, and there's so much to say about it, but and the international system in general. COVID is a world crisis. The problem was that the world really didn't rise to the occasion. It really became the solution for each nation, each state to solve this issue. and not in a concerted, united effort. And one of the problems related to a UN institution, which was a related institution, the World Health Organization. It's been documented that the Chinese have co-opted the WHO and its leadership. And at the beginning of the pandemic, information was not forthcoming, and even the WHO was, you know, papering over what was going on in China and not giving out the information. And it's very, very interesting that Condoleezza Rice gave a lecture on this topic, and it was very interesting. And she said that when she was Secretary of State, they reached out to China and asked for information on SARS. They couldn't get any information. So this has been a common problem all the way through, in terms of China's cooperation with the rest of the world, in terms of divulging what was going on. And of course, there's still a lot of debate about the sources of it. It's actually interesting. There's a lawsuit, I think it's in Missouri or some state in the United States, is suing China for damages for the pandemic. I'm just looking for when they send the request for information and discovery, what the Chinese are going to do. The point of the matter is that we don't know the answer to that, but we really do know that the stonewalling of the WHO really hurt the ability of the world to react to the pandemic. And the point is that China has infiltrated many of these organizations and co-opted them. I mean, I can give you a few examples of it. But as an institution, how does the UN function? Well, we've seen that in Ukraine. And it was quite, I think, dazzling or startling that when the United Nations tried to bring up in the Security Council Russia's invasion without any cause of Ukraine, the Russians, who were the president of the Security Council, can you imagine, vetoed that effort. Yet when the matter was taken up in the General Assembly, I think it's 141 states voted against Russia. There were abstentions, but the point, what I'm trying to get at is the official institution of the United Nations that's supposed to deal with threats to the peace, and after all, Ukraine is a member of the United Nations, it's a member state, failed miserably, didn't take action because it was stopped by the veto. Now, let's just understand what the veto is, why the veto is there, and that's really where the problem comes about. The United Nations system was set up after World War II to prevent a repeat of the aggression of the Second World War. And the idea was to create a system of collective security where attack on one would be an attack on all. But the most important principle of the UN system was to get the great powers to participate. It had to be an element of the UN system that the UN system could never take action against a great power. That was a fundamental way and to get these powers into the UN system, into the UN organization. Otherwise, they would not have joined. And this has been a real default defect of the UN. And we see it so markedly now with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Here, Russia is an aggressor. Here, Russia cannot be stopped. And this problem has permeated all the other institutions. Just to give you a few other examples of how this works or doesn't work. We have the International Court of Justice. And just to explain one thing about the International Court of Justice, which is very important to understand, it's not like when you go to a federal district court or New York State Supreme Court or the court in D.C. This is not a court that has the ability to force parties to, you know, you get a subpoena to go to court, you have to go to court. If you don't, you get in trouble. But not with the World Court. The World Court really isn't the World Court. What it does is provide for the following jurisdiction. It only has jurisdiction if parties to the issue, dispute, submit to the ICJ, or there's a treaty or agreement that says that disputes will be submitted to the ICJ. Now, it was very interesting the way the Ukraine got Russia sort of into the court. This was very, very original, very interesting. Ukraine went to the International Court of Justice. Russia didn't show up. Russia said, this is not, I don't have to appear. I don't agree with this. But interestingly, what the Ukraine said was, well, Russia accused Ukraine of genocide. And we're both parties to the Genocide Convention. Therefore, this is a dispute on the interpretation of the Genocide Convention. And that's how they brought Russia into the court. And actually, the court did say, did side with Ukraine and gave an order. Of course, China and Russia, the judges on the court didn't participate, didn't agree. But a 13 votes to 2 basically said, Russia, you have to stop your invasion. And in effect, end this aggression. Interesting point, next point, International Criminal Court. The Rome Statute. Now, for many reasons, the United States is not a party to this, neither is Israel. And the idea being that it infringes on sovereignty and the fear that the ICC would take jurisdiction over Americans, for example, in connection with the war in Iraq, and take out, you know, action against Americans. America never participated. But the point is, the ICC, International Criminal Court, has jurisdiction over war crimes, crimes against humanity. If you want a textbook case of war crimes and crimes against humanity, what Russia did in Ukraine, what it's doing in Ukraine, moving populations around, killing civilians, all the things that they're doing. But the ICC, again, is stymied. Why? Because at the end of the day, the real enforcement arm of the United Nations is the Security Council, where Russia has the veto. So it's sort of like a, by the way, I always love the analogy of the veto to the fuse box. Maybe some of us are old enough to remember fuse box, but the idea of the fuse box is the fuse blows, circuit stops. That's the veto. Once you invoke the veto, system stops, action stops, you can't do anything. So there are a lot of things going on here, a lot of potential. By the way, what does the ICJ do, the International Court of Justice? It does resolve water disputes and other disputes among states, not great powers. What does the International Criminal Court do? It did bring a number of rather bad people to justice, many, many in Africa, in connection is also a court in Yugoslavia, but not related to the great powers. So as we see, these institutions are not functional. And then we take the Human Rights Council. That's a good one. The Human Rights Council has some of the great star performers in human rights who sit on the council. China, Venezuela, Russia, Cuba, who have received such plaudits for their human rights suppression, right? So this council, and by the way, many of these, and this is for another, to look at another time maybe, in terms of Israel, the ICC has been very forthright in terms of looking into the situation in Israel and the war crimes committed by Israel. This is just an aside. On certain things, they're fixated, but they're not fixated on the resolution of disputes and crises. IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency. Again, look at the nuclear deal. Look at Iran. A perfectly admirable organization that's been headed up by some very good people, but they can't do the job because there is pushback again against the great powers. So WHO, ICC, ICJ, UNHCR, and so forth. Of course, the WTO. The whole idea was to bring China to the WTO so China would become a regular nation and would trade in an ordinary fashion. Quite the opposite. So what's really going on here? And the co-optation of China, which I mentioned before. China is one of the greatest contributors to the UN system, and it also has leading authority in four of them, at least, Food and Agriculture Organization, International Telecommunications Organization, UN Industrial Development Organization, International Civil Aviation Organization. And you must ask yourself, why do they bother to do this? And the answer is, I think, very clear, because a state like China wants to use the United Nations and the UN system to add to its power and to prevent China, and also in this case of Russia, to be criticized, to have action taken against it. Now, we've seen recently sort of a bright spot here with NATO, when NATO came up with NATO 2030 and came up with a mission, and then it actually had its mission validated, which was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which has caused a real coalescing on NATO. NATO is a good example of a successful regional body. But in terms of international organizations, American foreign policy always was even in connection with China and Russia, is to bring them into these organizations and to make them into normal powers, regular powers. Now, if you look at it a little bit more critically, you'll see that China does not respect, and Russia certainly, the decisions of international organizations. One example, of course, is the decision of the Permanent Court of Arbitration on China's building of these artificial islands in the South China Sea. I really advocate, if you ever have time, you have about 20 cups of coffee, read the 500-page decision, which comes to the point that the judges said all of China's claims in the South China Sea are bunk, bogus, no basis. No, and Iraq is not an island. It's nonsense. What did the Chinese say after this was issued? It's a piece of trash. And I think that all of what they do is use the international organizations as the same as Russia. And by the way, how did China get into all of this, get into this situation? America. America helped China, the People's Republic of China, to come into the United Nations. And what did China do in the United Nations? Well, it tries to continue to suppress Taiwan's involvement in international affairs. It continues to try to keep the world from focusing on its persecution of the Uyghurs and many other things that they do to manipulate the system. So the picture in our international system is very, very bleak. Now, just one thing, and I just like to mention this. It may not seem on point, but I think it is so important to understand what is China all about, right? Well, the Chinese Communist Party has a definite ideology. Xi is the leader for life. I mean, we know all that. The Belt and Road Initiative, and this is an interesting thing too, the Chinese influence in the UN has been applied to bring the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, into the sustainable development goals, to make that a goal. But what is the goal really of the BRI? It is to put states into debt that they cannot repay. And then in order to get those states out of debt, the Chinese say, no problem. You don't have to pay back the loan. Just let me build a military base. Let me militarize your port. And this has happened in Vanuatu and all around the world. In Rem, in Cambodia. Now, I just wanted to read one thing. I think this is so interesting. Council of Li of China, Wang Yi, gave a talk to the Council on Foreign Relations, and he made the following statement. This really gives you an idea, because he keeps saying, well, China's a democracy. Why do you keep criticizing us? And he says this: democracy is not Coca-Cola, which with syrup produced in the United States tastes the same across the world. China's social democracy is a whole process, most representative democracy. I never heard of Coca-Cola being used in that way, but it is really an indicative of where they are thinking. What are they thinking? They're thinking about really as an existential threat against the United States to increase their power and influence against the United States. If they can link up with Russia, they will do that as well. I saw a hearing the other day on C-SPAN. I thought I would fall off my chair. They were talking about the Chinese militarization. Extraordinary. And it was interesting that they have a large number of road mobile missiles, nukes. We don't have any. So Chinese have used these institutions. They have a very, very firm and clear vision on what they want to do, their direction forward, but the United States has facilitated the One China policy, bringing them into the WTO and all the other things that we've done. Now we're waking up. We started to wake up. COVID helped America to wake up. We're waking up. When we saw what happened with COVID, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is also a wake-up call. And the question is, what should we do about it? So it's a very, very vexing point. There was a recent article in Foreign Affairs about the outsiders, and the argument Professor Goddard makes is, you know, we should keep them. It's kind of the Don Corleone principle of international affairs, you know, keep your enemies close, that way you have a connection to them, you know what they're doing. It's questionable to what extent can the international institutions continue to thrive and deal with their raison d'etre, which is to solve world crisis and world conflict. There are a few things that have come up as ideas to handle violations of human rights and other things like that. For example, universal jurisdiction, which Germany implemented against a Syrian officer who tortured detainees. The idea, a number of countries have said, wherever you commit an atrocity, you can be tried in my state. This is problematic because we have a sovereign state system. The whole concept of sovereignty, and that's an interesting point in and of itself, is that Russia invaded Ukraine in a way that is sort of Iraq invading Kuwait, is to destroy Ukraine. The idea that this is a wake-up call of something so shocking that we really haven't seen. I don't think we saw something like this. The last time was in Crimea. We saw this. The world did nothing. The other thing that has been talked about is responsibility to protect, which is meant to protect people who are being persecuted in states. Again, very hard to implement because of the international system of sovereign states. I think the point, and my basic point, is that the America needs to have a clear vision. By the way, on institutions in general, I think if you took a poll around about Americans, what Americans think about their own institutions, they would be not very sanguine about them. I think congressmen are way down in popularity with journalists. The polls show a lack of support. Now with Supreme Court, with Roe v. Wade, we just have all kinds of challenges to the idea that our institutions can handle issues. And of course, the COVID situation is a shock to our system in the sense that there's so much confusion about the role of government in solving problems. And the same problem exists in the international system. Now, what should be the goal? And again, this is, I think I should conclude, right, Shoshana, at this point? Is that good? Okay. So the last point is a very interesting book by Hedley Bull called The Anarchical Society. Clearly, the international system is anarchical. We just demonstrated it. The international courts can't enforce anything. The UN has a veto. The UNHCR has violators of human rights. It just pervades, and China's in there trying to build its own persona. But Hedley Bull says what we should go for is a society of states. Now, you might think I'm being very idealistic, but I think it's good to be idealistic also to hope for a better world. He says the society of states exists when a group of states conscious of certain common interests and common values form a society in the sense that they conceive themselves to be bound by a common set of rules in their relations with one another and share in the working of common institutions. I'm sure that was the whole idea of why the founders of the UN, why they got together. They were trying to get to this point. So the question is, do we allow China and Russia to remain sort of as moles in the system, to dig away at the system and destroy the system against the idea of freedom and democracy in the world? And to eschew the idea that if you want something, you just invade a state and start killing their people? That has to stop. And that requires a world consensus. There has to be some sort of a world order. And my last point is, it's sort of like that game show. And I mean, it's like the three doors. There's the American rule-based order, law is the guide, international rules-based order. There's the Chinese door and the Russian door. And I say this to people all around the world all the time, pick one. Which is the one that you want? And I think with the coalescing of NATO, with the response of the United States, albeit, not perfect, it shows the potential for collective security, collective action. And the last point is China has been watching this very carefully. They've been watching how has the world reacted. And with all of these system defects, the world has reacted against Russia, perhaps not perfectly, but have given, I think, if the writing on the wall for China will be about Taiwan, that if they try something in Taiwan, they will find it not as simple an effort as it is. Anyway, that's where I'll stop, and I hope I covered much of what I wanted.
You covered a lot, and maybe we'll cover some more in the Q&A. people want to talk about what you said, and people want to introduce a couple of new subjects. So I'm going to try to lump some questions together. One of the things that you did not talk about very much is having an enforcement mechanism for treaties. You talked about the ICJ and the UN and the IAEA, which has no enforcement mechanism for Iran. It can complain, and we have a rules-based order, but we don't have an enforcement-based order. And so there are people who say that countries like China will join the UN and join the WHO and agree to play by the rules, but only as long as it suits them. And then they violate the rules and nothing happens to them. True in the U.S. as well, says another person. We're not removing the protesters from the homes of the Supreme Court justices. Instead, we're providing the justices with protection. But the law says you have to remove them. We're also not defending our southern border. We're also not prosecuting shoplifters. Where's our enforcement mechanism, Mark?
Well, these are two really different subjects in a way, because, again, I quoted Hedley Bull, the Anarchical Society. No one thought because we have a sovereign state system, no one really thought that we wanted to undermine that. I mean, in other words, we believe in sovereignty, we believe in American sovereignty. In fact, America has adopted in its own law principles of sovereignty, international law, following international law. Even when it's detrimental to us, to our interests, America follows international law. This is particularly the case in the law of the sea, which I did my dissertation on, and it's very true. The United States supported the United Nations, supports the rule of law, and sometimes it's not advantageous to our own domestic interests. But about the enforcement of the treaties, well, there are mechanisms and there are ways to do it. And treaties, there are enforcement mechanisms in not just international courts, but regional courts. There are courts set up under the treaties themselves that are arbitral mechanisms, to deal with trade disputes and other disputes. But about China, how do you solve that problem? I don't see how you solve that problem. I mean, this is an old problem. I mean, this goes back to the whole way in which businesses in the United States were dealing with China for many, many years. And the idea was if you had a contract with China, China could just terminate it. And they didn't have to have a reason. And there was no recourse against them. You just took a chance and dealt with them. You know, there has to be a little realpolitik here. There has to be a little realism and flexing of muscles of the United States. The whole idea of bringing China in as a trade partner, they're still a trade partner. That's the amazing thing about this, is a very convoluted issue. And it also relates, to turn it to the domestic politics that you mentioned, all politics is local, to quote Tip O'Neill. It is, because our domestic system gives a reflection to what we do in the world. There's no question about it. So about the points that were raised about the American system, I think our system and our society is in disarray. There's no question about it. And there is a feeling that I think is widespread that we're so polarized that we can't have any agreement on basic principles and basic norms. This is very problematic. We need to get back to that. You know, the last sort of vestige of this is the filibuster and the cloture. And then, you know, the Democrats talk about, gee whiz, that we're going to get rid of that. And with the hope, if you look back, it started a number of years ago into whittling away the idea of the filibuster, which was a very good thing because it forced compromise. And in our historical, if you look at American history, you'll see some of the greatest things that Americans did was by compromise. Even the Constitution itself was a battle over differing interests, which was solved by compromise. And throughout our history, we've had compromise. But right now, no one is in the mood to compromise. Everybody is either my way or the highway. And that is indicative of what we're seeing here and mentioning in the situation with Roe v. Wade. I mean, this is a tremendous conundrum. And I don't know. I'm sure Justice Roberts is sitting right now trying to think how he's going to solve this one, because, you know, he pulled the bunny out of the hat with the Obamacare, where he said it's a tax, and that was never argued it was all about interstate commerce. So on this one, hopefully they can come up with something, but that is not a panacea for what ails us, which is internal dissent, internal disagreement on basic core principles, to quote Hedley Bull. There just isn't agreement on those basic ideas. About the border and shoplifters and all of that, what's to say about that? I think what happens is you end up with politics interfering with the idea, and here it's the rule of law, not on the grand scale of the Pacific or the Atlantic or Russia or Ukraine, it's just on the streets of the United States. And there we're in a pitch battle, and we need to get back to basics and the idea that law has to be followed. Law has to be followed, including the one you mentioned in connection with Supreme Court justices. I mean, this kind of behavior, much of this behavior that we're seeing today, was unheard of in the past. And just crossing lines and evading the law is a very bad thing. But our politicians, they need to do something better than fight with each other.
Okay.
It
doesn't solve anything, but it goes to the real question of why do we have consensus? Why do we have laws in international institutions as well as in the United States, if when it comes to enforcing them, people suddenly draw back and say, no, I can't do that for one reason or another. So you have the Security Council. Now, let's go to NATO, which, true, got a big boost in the Ukraine war, as you mentioned. And Finland and Sweden, I think, are going to have their memberships approved. So it's even expanded itself. But it doesn't have a consensus yet on how to deal with Russia. The Europeans have not cut off all their energy imports, and the Germans have said they're not sure they can do that anyway. They think they may be beyond cutting themselves off from Russia. I think it was easier to deal with the question of NATO and Russia when it was the Volga Gap. And if the Russian tanks came across the gap, everyone was going to fight the Russians. A couple of questions arise here. How do we deal with the fact that even within the institution, there are different foreign policies? Secondly, is the United States still strong enough, big enough, secure enough in itself and its position in the world to move NATO to a consensus on these things? And if not, then what happens to NATO?
Well, I mean, you mentioned Sweden and Finland, and I think to me that is very, very indicative of how important NATO is. Of course, Turkey has objections to Sweden and Finland, and I think the president is meeting with some leaders of Sweden.
Yeah, would you explain that? Because Turkey is your area. People, I think, don't understand quite what Turkey's problem is. So if you could help, that would be good.
Turkey's problem with this issue is the fact that the Swedes and the Finns have been very supportive, according to the Turks, of the PKK, and in particular, that's the terrorist group in Turkey, but in particular, the YPG and PYD, which is the Syrian Kurdish offshoot, which the Turks say is inextricably connected to the PKK. But they are not on any terrorist list. The PKK is on terrorist list. And the Turks say, well, how can the Swedes and the Finns allow, you know, to support these groups? They've got to cut that out. And so there are delegations, I think, going to Turkey. They're going to talk about this. But the way in which NATO works, which is kind of a bad thing, is kind of how the Articles of Confederation worked in the United States, is you need a unanimous vote on everything in order to admit a member. All 30 members have to agree. Turkey said no, everybody else said yes. Is that a misstep? I mean, you know, I think so in a way, because if you saw in the Wall Street Journal today, this has precipitated some very strong discussion. Senator Lieberman has an op-ed piece saying, you know, why should Turkey be in NATO at all? So, you know, sometimes when you shine a light on an issue, you know, people shine it back. But I think this one will get resolved. I mean, it's kind of interesting because, Turkey is trying to use this one point as a lever. It really, I think, contradicts its efforts on Ukraine and supplying, weaponry to the TB2, the Bayraktar drone, which has been very, very important for the Ukrainians, particularly the sinking of their ship, the Moskva. They use those drones to target the ship. Providing weapons, being a host negotiator. At the same time, Turkey has not participated in sanctions. So it's been able to kind of sit somewhere on the balancing test. But this one, pushes them over the side, because all the other NATO states agree with this, and they've been highly criticized for that. So the answer is their issue about the Kurds, Kurdish terrorists, they claim the YPG, PYD in Syria, is in fact a terrorist group connected up to the PKK, and why the Swedes and the Finns, in fact, and interestingly enough, apparently have offices or actions, activities inside Sweden and Finland. So these discussions are ongoing, and I think a delegation today is going to be talking, and Biden will be talking to them. The question here is, I think, is an interesting question. It's kind of, if Biden meets with the Swedes and the Finns and he says, I want them in NATO, and that is pivotal, very important. Finland is such an important litmus test for NATO. Why is that? Because Finland's been invaded by the Russians, and Finland pushed them back. Over 700,000 Russian troops, and the Finns with their white uniforms on skis pushed back. And today, there are 600,000 Finns who are ready for combat. No, I have the wrong number. 280,000 ready, 600,000 in reserve. It almost reminds me of Israel. It's a whole state defense. Finland is ready for a full state defense. They are ready to mobilize up and defend themselves. And I just don't see how Russia would dare to do that one again. So the point is, putting Finland and Sweden in NATO is clearly pivotal to the survival of NATO. But let's go back to NATO for a moment and understand. So NATO 2030, which was their mission statement, which is pre-Ukraine invasion. But of course, it's post-Crimea, right? Post-Georgia. If you go back and look, what did NATO say about Crimea, Georgia? I looked. Very bad. We don't agree. It's very bad what you just did to invade Crimea. That was a shocking moment. The invasion of Crimea, that should have been pushed back, but there wasn't the wherewithal to do it. It is very interesting that the Russians complain about, you know, NATO expansion and all of that. But the point is, and I think it was the president of Finland or Sweden who said, hey, you know, who caused it? You did. It's because you invaded Ukraine that now we are insecure. So I think that it is a combination of the U.S. strength to be able to mobilize this alliance and Article 5, which is the key to NATO, which is an attack on one is an attack on all, collective security. And that seems to be working. I don't think, on the other hand, that when Biden says, oh, you know, if you attack the NATO country, that would be World War III and all of that. Sometimes it's better not to articulate those points and leave it open to the aggressor to worry that if I cross the line here or say that Ukraine is a minor incursion or anything like that, I am going to have the full force of NATO against me. Now, NATO, and again, this came, it's very interesting. Because many scholars were looking at this before February 24th, and I don't know how many, you know, out there is kind of people thinking outside the box. Most everybody said Putin will never, ever invade. But if you listen to Fiona Hill, who knows Russia very well, she has said, I think, she said, anything you think Putin won't do, he'll do it. Anytime you think he won't cross the line, he crosses the line. So he crossed this line. And that coalesced NATO. So I think it is a combination of U.S. leadership and European resolve. Now, European resolve is not perfect. They still have their problems, their internal problems, and the issue of energy. They are dependent on energy. And the United States was not up to the occasion. We did not ready for the occasion to be there, to be able, if we're stopping fracking in the United States and we're doing all the things we're doing internally, right? Now the United States is starting to hopefully get more leases up too, but that's short term. That's not going to happen. I'm sorry. That's long term. That's not short term. Europe needs to be able to come into the winter and survive. So, again, I think we've got a lot, by the way, as much as people would be pessimistic about this, I think we've come a long way. Germany was just giving helmets to Ukraine when this started, right? And now they're in it. They're in it. So I think we're getting better, and it has a lot to do with U.S. strength and power in the world. And the fact of the matter is, it's a wake-up call. The Europeans understand that if Russia can do this to actually harm and attack a member state, and try to destroy it. He could do it to any of them. And what's the irony? The irony is Ukraine was a nuclear power. It was, I think, the third largest number of nukes in the world. And what did they do? They signed on a document that said Russia will guarantee the United States too, will guarantee your security. You can give up your nukes. Don't you worry. Okay. So this also puts a bit of a damper on the idea that international agreements have validity and efficacy. Russia, COVID-19 with China, the world woke up. Russia with the Ukraine aggression, the world had a shocking wake up. So with these things, as bleak as they may seem, we're going to do better. And without this, we would have been totally lost. And remember, the Soviet Union collapsed. Always remember that. The Soviet Union collapsed. So Putin's regime could collapse. The Chinese regime could collapse. What glues them together, Putin is Putin and his oligarchs. China is the Communist Party. And so I'm not so sure. They're all very powerful and formidable. China, much more than Russia. They got together at the Olympics, were worried about their combination. But America is there with the Europeans. And I think with all of the pessimism, there's still optimism.
So this led to two questions. The first is on China and your view of the Chinese economy. Chinese collapse would almost have to have something to do with the collapse in the Chinese economy. Do you see any evidence that could be on the horizon for them? And that would be one. And then I'll get to the other one.
I don't know the answer to that, but if you look at what happened with the COVID lockdowns in China, that has been a slam to their system. And I think that about the economy, I think their economy is strong. And for the time being, they're still using the manipulative practices to bolster their economy. And I think in a large way, we're still subjected to that. So I don't think in the short term we're going to, destroy the Chinese economy. We have to work with the Chinese economy, obviously. The question is, how do we get to a situation where we can actually work with the Chinese in a normal, it's kind of a normative word, in a normal way? By the way, one other thing I wanted to mention is this concept of equilibrium that is shocked to the system of equilibrium. We have had stable in a sense. We haven't had any really big invasions since World War II. And this invasion, again, is a real game changer. I just want to mention that. Anyway, what was the other one?
Okay, so the other part of this was, it's definitely been shown that Russia's conventional capabilities in warfare are less than we thought they were. We had a slightly inflated, very inflated view of Russian capabilities. Question for you. Does that make chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons use more likely if someone is determined to win a war? And the question that goes with that is, are international norms enough to prevent that? Didn't prevent the use of chemicals in Syria, and the Russians paid no price at all for the decimation of Grozny, which is said to have been one of the most thoroughly destroyed cities in the entire world at any time. So is the inability of the Russians to use their conventional forces loosely to get where they want to go, does that make non-conventional warfare more likely?
I wanted to clarify that what I was saying before, it's punctuated equilibrium. That's what I wanted to say. Stephen Jay Gould, I wanted to give credit where credit is due. So our equilibrium was punctuated by the use of the conventional weaponry to attack Ukraine. And the question is, are we going to have another shocker in terms of chemical, biological, or nuclear? I'm going to say something about nuclear, but in a moment. But I think that it's unknown. I mean, it is unknown. I mean, we just don't know the answer to that. And again, What did these weapons accomplish? Well, maybe Putin would use tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield. It's possible, but that's crossing a line. That is kind of, there was a book years ago called Thinking About the Unthinkable. Well, nuclear weapons used last time, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's kind of the unthinkable that we were using nuclear weapons in a natural conflict, but also on the battlefield. And you know, how have we developed our policy on nukes, which is mutually assured destruction? And just to touch on that, and that was based on the idea that if one power attacked the other, Russia, America, whatever, the other would destroy, they'd destroy each other and the world would be destroyed. So if you have a rational actor, a rational player, you know, rationally, you wouldn't do that. And of course, in the case of Iran, getting a nuclear weapon, that doesn't really work very well because they're really not a rational actor. Some think they are, but you really don't know. We've worked, this has been the basis of it. So when you hear Putin say, I'm going to use nuclear weapons because you just said something about Russia or you don't like what I did in Ukraine, and I'm raising up my nuclear preparedness level, the United States happily didn't react to that. We're in something brand new that is a contingency that we really didn't think about. We really didn't think about Russia as a nuclear power with agreements. By the way, the agreements which Russia violates routinely with us, actually doing this or actually using these nukes. Chemical, biological, as you said, we had the red line in Syria, it was violated. So the answer to this is we don't know the answer to it. But about the conventional warfare, I think, you know, the emperor has no clothes. I mean, Russia was shown, you know, even on the tires on the vehicles were cheaply made and got stuck because they were, you know, made by a corrupt system. So, you know, and everybody's worried about Putin saving face. I don't know. Does he save face if he attacks with chemical, biological, and nuclear? We don't know the status of Putin. We don't know his personal status. We don't know what's going on internally. Would the military in Russia permit this to happen? Because it could cause the complete conflagration. And that one I don't know the answer to. I think the answer is that the response of the United States with its allies and all levels, I'm talking about the Quad, I'm talking about AUKUS, I'm talking about all of our allies and all of our alliances, NATO, that's the way to prevent this. If an aggressor will come along and do it, and again, as Fiona Hill says, if you don't think he'll do it, Putin will do it. This time, maybe, because if you looked at the parade on Victory Day in Russia, Putin was somewhat more restrained. People thought he was going to mobilize the whole Russian military, and he was going to annex you, the Donbass and the Luhansk. And he didn't do anything. He just said, I'm right because Ukrainians are Nazis and whatever he said, which is so ridiculous. But the point being, he was more restrained. Now, does that mean he's going to be restrained on this? Who knows? You know, the Kremlinologists out there, remember, we're always counting who's with Brezhnev, who's with Khrushchev. What's Putin saying? What about the oligarchs? We're still doing this. We're counting the tea leaves. The answer is we really don't know.
So we're coming to the end of the program, Mark. And you've been fairly optimistic about the capability of the West in general. And I'm glad you mentioned the Quad and AUKUS because we didn't really get into that conversation. But our alliances in the Pacific are very important to us. And people that listen more than once know that I like to end on a positive note. You've already given us some of those. So here is a question that I hope will lead you to a positive conclusion to our program.
Okay.
The listener writes, has the idea of a council of democracies with power, one whose time has come? Now, I don't know where he's planning for us to get the power, but is the idea of a council of democracies a useful concept? So we'd leave out people like Russia and China.
And Turkey was also not invited to the summit on democracy by President Biden. You know, a nice idea, you know, democracy. What does democracy mean? I mean, you have the People's Republic of China. You have the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. China, Councilor Wang says, we are represented. What is it? Coca-Cola. It's not America has the right to say what's democratic. So I'm not so sure. But at the same time, maybe not institutionally, but the idea of freedom and the idea of democracy. And this is a real uplifting point. So I think this is the high. I can go no higher than Kilimanjaro in this one. The idea of freedom and democracy. And the idea that the people of the world look at the Statue of Liberty and look at America as a beacon, as a city on a hill. This was Ronald Reagan. We talked about Reagan before. America as a city on a hill, this idea that came from the Puritans. The idea that all eyes of the world are on us. That's how we have to keep thinking. We cannot give that up. As much as there are many who in America and elsewhere think America, you know, is has, you know, empires have expiration dates and your empire is over. America is the bastion of democracy, it's always been. And the idea that we believe in freedom, we believe in democracy, we believe in human rights. Our soldiers do not leave our soldiers behind. We do the things we do. And I believe from my heart, because I know my parents came here, they were immigrants, and I was born here. And this country is absolutely a most unique country in the world. With that idea that America's there for the world, I think the rest of the world has hope. So Democrats in the world and those people who are being persecuted in China and in Russia and Belarus or wherever, they know that there is a place on earth that will always hold true to the principle of freedom, democracy, and human rights. That's America. And as long as we're here, keep fighting for our ideas, I think the world is going to, there'll be a turnaround and things are going to get better. That's optimistic.
That's optimistic. I'm done. I have no comment. Mark Meyerowitz, thank you for a great program.
Thank you very much for enlightening us.
And thank you for opening us to the kind of broad concepts that will allow us to think about the world and think about what's happening in it. I hope we'll see you again.
Thank you very much for the privilege and honor to do this.